You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
In his famous essay on the reading of old books, C.S. Lewis praises the texts of ages past not because they were so often right, none of us bats a thousand, but that in being wrong and being right about very different questions, they make apparent to us, future dwellers, that we're not answering their questions otherwise than they did, but in many cases we've abandoned their questions, and we've taken on questions that wouldn't have even occurred to them. One of his proposals, which I bring with me into every classroom where I teach Sophocles and Plato and Dante and Chaucer, is that we might be able to answer our own questions better if we took the time to attend to our ancestors' questions alongside our moment's own questions. Francis Beckwith's book, Never Doubt Thomas, from Baylor University Press, does just such things, bringing Thomas Aquinas to bear not only on natural law, as we might expect, but also to questions of evolution and creation, the religious claims of Muslims and Jews, and even matters in which Protestants and Catholics can talk intelligently and charitably about our shared medieval intellectual history. Christian Humanist Profiles is glad to have Dr. Beckwith on the show today. Frank, thanks for coming aboard.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a delight.
This book obviously emerges from your encounters with Thomas's writings. That's what happens when an author writes about another author. But you really kind of foreground your own journey in its opening chapter. So what are a couple of the moments that joined you in significant ways with the theologian of creation and beatitude?
Yeah, I grew up in a Catholic family and kind of drifted away when I was a teenager, becoming Protestant, evangelical Protestant. But when I was in elementary school, my parents encouraged me to attend this retreat at the parish center. And it was run by a couple of Dominican priests who as a precocious kid, I challenged them. I argued with them. I arrived with my Bible in hand and they told me about Thomas Aquinas. And that was the first time I heard about Aquinas. And it was, I don't recall ever from that point or at that point going to read Aquinas, but it was later as I became an older evangelical kid and right after high school, I was drawn to philosophy as a major. I had an interest in questions of faith and reason. And one of the first thinkers that I was introduced to by an evangelical author was Thomas Aquinas. And then I remembered, when I was a kid, that was one of the people that I had heard of. And obviously, as a Catholic, I knew of Aquinas. He had written not only books on theology and philosophy, but he had also written hymns that we sung in church and many prayers and things like that. So that my first exposure to Aquinas was as a kid and then later as a young adult in college. And then when I went off to graduate school and did my PhD at Fordham University, I took courses from several well-known Thomists. And at the time, I didn't know they were well-known. I was just taking classes from Father Clark and Father McCool, as I knew them. It was only later, as I became a professor myself, that I realized that they were of such great stature. But Aquinas was really helpful for me as a young evangelical philosopher to kind of think through issues of faith and reason. And then when I returned to the Catholic Church 12 years ago as an adult, I began to go back to Aquinas. Much of my own work in philosophy over the past 30 years has mostly been in ethics and political philosophy and a little bit in philosophy of religion. So I approach Aquinas not as an Aquinas scholar. I don't consider myself an Aquinas scholar, but as somebody who is a follower of Aquinas and wants to learn more.
Very good, very good. Well, when I started reading this book, I'll be honest, I expected a standard introduction to the author kind of a book, a brief biography, and then brief discussions of major themes, major works. Instead, this book takes on some contemporary questions in Christian thought and brings Thomas to bear as we kind of answer them together. And the first such question is natural law, which might not strike our listeners as one that is pervasive as it is, but when I read your book, you convinced me that it is. So convince our listeners as well. What sorts of people are natural law thinkers without realizing it, and what kind of clarity can Thomas lend to their inquiries?
Yeah, what we think of natural law today, at least when we hear it sort of bandied about in the public square, we usually think of it as a kind of replacement for public reason liberalism. So what do I mean by that? So there's a kind of general way of thinking about our politics, at least in Western European and North American contexts, of that if a religious person enters the public square, they should have public reasons. That is, reasons that are not tightly tethered to their theological tradition. And they are welcome to offer their policies and suggestions, but they can't give sort of religious or biblical type of answers. And so a lot of people think, well, natural law arguments are kind of non-religious in the sense that they are arguments that you can give that rely on reason, but also get you to conclusions that may be more congenial to more traditional religious points of view. I don't think that's what Thomas Aquinas is doing. I think when Aquinas is offering his natural law theory or his view of natural law, he's really not trying to offer it as a kind of way to persuade people who may not agree with Christians on moral or ethical issues, although I think you could certainly use natural law in that way. He's trying to explain why it is that it seems that human beings in general seem to be inclined to certain goods. So, for instance, to give a kind of simple example, years ago I had a student when I taught at the University of Nevada who asked me in class, why is the truth important? And I answered, do you want the true answer or the false one? And the response was a kind of natural law response. That is, we have a natural inclination to the truth that we make judgments all the time about ignorance or absence of knowledge as being a bad thing. And we also kind of extend that to other aspects of what we consider to be good. So, for instance, if you hear of somebody having taken their own life, the first question that you may ask is, well, why did they do it? Right. Well, we don't ask that question if somebody happens to be alive. We don't say, you know, I saw Fred walking around the quad today. And you say, well, why did that happen? We don't, because we think that it's a sort of natural thing for human beings to be inclined to want to live because we are naturally ordered towards our own good. Now, Aquinas believes we can be mistaken about our own good, but we always are inclined towards the good. So the way in which I think people become skeptical of natural law is that they discover that people disagree on a variety of moral questions. And they think, well, natural law thinkers say these are sort of fundamental principles of the natural law that everybody knows. Well, if everybody knows them, how come they disagree on issues like abortion or same-sex marriage or a variety of other public questions? And I think Aquinas has an answer to that. And the answer is that we're inclined to these goods, but that we're oftentimes we can be mistaken. So an example, we can either be mistaken or that we can be moved by certain passions that lead us to make judgments that are inaccurate. So example I use in the book is I have students that know that it is wrong to plagiarize, and yet they do it anyways. In fact, I say in the book that I had a student whose plagiarism was so bad, not even his sin was original. So
nice.
So why do they do it? Well, because they have passions. They have what Aquinas calls irascible and concupiscible passions. They are, you know, they want to get a good grade, and they are tempted to do other things rather than study, right? So they violate what they know is part of the natural law. It's wrong to steal. Sometimes people hold beliefs about reality that change the way they apply the natural law. So an illustration I use is the debate about abortion. I have my own view is that I'm pro-life. I'm opposed to abortion, but I have friends who are philosophers who disagree with me. Now, I don't believe that they whole, that I don't believe that they think it is right to kill innocent persons. They just deny that fetuses are innocent persons. And they have an elaborate way of arguing that fetuses are human beings, but not persons. And what they mean by persons is a kind of list of characteristics that they believe that if any being exhibits, gives them moral status. Again, it's a view I don't hold, but I at the end of the day, it turns out that we actually both agree that it is wrong to intentionally kill innocent persons. We disagree on a metaphysical question, namely, what counts as a person? And that is not a question of morality. It's really a question of metaphysics. And so I think that one of the criticisms that's often leveled against Aquinas is not only that we can make that people disagree, and I think you can account for those disagreements, but also that human beings, this comes from the more theological critics, that human beings are suffer from total depravity, that they suffer from the noetic effects of sin. And I think Aquinas's explanation of how people make mistakes as a consequence of their passions addresses that. And in fact, in a weird way, he agrees with a lot of the critics of natural law. He says, yes, people make mistakes all the time, and here's why they make those mistakes.
Well, I think it's interesting that the language of mistakes is the one that you're using here, because I happen to have taught the opening chapters of Augustine's Confessions recently. And in the pear tree episode, that, you know, probably one of the more famous episodes in that book, he talks not necessarily about mistaken passions, but a sort of usurping desire, you know, that the more violent sins, and I'm pulling on Dante's categories here, I realize, but the sins of violence come from an urge to usurp what is properly God. So it strikes me as a more, well, I mean, a more violent language than what you're using here. I mean, does Aquinas distinguish that way, the way that Dante does, or does Aquinas regard all of these things as mistakes the way that a Socrates might regard them?
Yeah, you're probably right. I think there's just a tendency for philosophers like me to use the kind of you know, kind of sterile, antiseptic language of analytic philosophy. So that would be how analytic philosophers talk about mistakes. But I think you're right. Technically, especially if you read Aquinas on the passions, and he does definitely use the language of you use the term violent, but he would also use language of kind of disorder. And also, you know, I don't think he would use, you know, I'm trying to think of a place where he has used it. He's not obviously as good a writer as Augustine, doesn't use a lot of that colorful language, but he does use the language of sorrow and pleasure. And he would say, for example, that the attempt to sort of usurp God's authority comes from, in a weird way, the natural inclination we have to the beatific vision, but it's a kind of disordered, it's disordered by our passions in some way.
That's fair enough. You mentioned the frequent Protestant objection to natural law. And usually the Protestant answer is to say that, you know, it's the text of the Bible, not natural reason, not natural law, that leads us to these things. One of the cases that you make that I found really interesting is that certain biblical narratives actually assume something like natural law in order to make sense as narratives. Can you talk about a biblical narrative or two that does that?
Yeah, so the one I bring up is, how did Cain know that it was wrong to murder his brother Abel? If you think about it, there's nothing prior to that that we're told, that, you know, there was no particular revelation, no covenant, but yet he was held accountable for murdering his brother. The one I like in particular is something that kind of occurred to me once while reading the New Testament, when Jesus tells his audience what a good father would never do, that is, he wouldn't give his child a loaf of bread and say that it's a scorpion, right? Well, that assumes that the audience knows what good fathers are supposed to do, right? Or even the case of the Good Samaritan, right? The one person that acts well in that particular parable is the one person who doesn't have the Mosaic law, who is not under the Mosaic law. So I think that the scriptures actually presuppose in some places the natural law without actually calling it that.
Or at the very least doesn't have the prophets. I think the Samaritans did have the Torah, just not the prophets.
That's right, yeah.
Very good. So, well, when you do outline the limits of natural law, and you do grant that there are limits, you write about, quote, preambles of faith, close quote, that do some good work, but not the work of revelation. So what does that phrase, preambles of faith, mean in Thomas's thought? Because I thought this was a particularly useful intellectual tool as well.
Yeah, so Aquinas distinguishes between the preambles of faith and the articles of faith. So what he means by the preambles of faith are those things that we could know through our natural reason about God and the human soul and even morality. In fact, when he talks about natural law, I'm not even sure natural law is necessarily a preamble of faith, because he thinks that everyone kind of knows it. They don't have to actually have an elaborate set of arguments. But I guess you could argue that, I suppose you could say it is part of the preambles of faith. So those are things that we can know apart from special revelation. And the articles of faith are those things that we can only know through special revelation, things like that God is a Trinity, that Christ died for our sins, that the scriptures are inspired, and so forth. And in fact, when he lists the articles of faith, they are kind of parallel to what some of us recite in the Apostles' Creed. And so those are things that we can know about God, that we can only know about God through special revelation. Now, it turns out the preambles of faith and the articles of faith sometimes overlap each other. But you don't need to know the articles of faith in a sort of argumentative sense in order to assent to the articles of faith. And I think this is one of the misunderstandings that people have when it comes to Aquinas's view of natural theology.
Give an example of that, because I that is a useful point, but I think our listeners could use an example.
Okay, so the example I use in the book, well, first off, let me explain the sort of criticism. The criticism goes something like this. Aquinas teaches that in order for one to have faith in God, they must first know God's existence rationally. Now, for Aquinas, rationally doesn't mean the way in which we use the term today. So when we use the term rational or reasonable, we mean, you know, someone has, you know, has a plausible case for something. He means it in the sense of having a deductively valid argument for, let's say, God's existence. And a deductively valid argument is an argument in which if you accept both premises, the conclusion must follow. In other words, once you see it, you know it's true. So if I say, for example, all bachelors are unmarried, Fred is a bachelor, I know immediately that Fred is unmarried. I can't, like, not believe it. It just follows deductively, and my reason leads me to it immediately. And Aquinas believes there are arguments for God's existence in the human soul that are like that, that they're deductively valid arguments. And so one of the criticisms against Aquinas is, well, he believes that you need that as a preamble of faith in the sense that you need it as a prerequisite to believe. But that's not what Aquinas says at all. In fact, he says that one can believe all the things in the articles of faith without having any argument for God's existence, because believing in those things is a matter of God's grace moving the human soul to assent. If it were the case that you needed deductive arguments, that would mean that it was entirely up to us to believe, which would make Aquinas fall prey to the Pelagian heresy. That is, it would mean that grace wasn't necessary to believe in God as we believe in God when we assent to the articles of faith. So the example I use in the book is I give this scenario or the story of two individuals, Tony and Tina. Tony is an Uber driver in Las Vegas, and he believes in God, but he doesn't he's not a Christian. He doesn't belong to any religious group. He just grew up being taught that God exists, and he believes in God, but he doesn't really have an argument. He just thinks God exists. Tina, on the other hand, is a philosophy professor at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, teaches medieval philosophy, and has studied the arguments of Avicenna, Aquinas, and Maimonides, and has come to a conclusion that God exists, that there is a self-existent creator of all that exists, and it's something she believes as a result of the argument. Both Tony and Tina have a kind of belief in a preamble of faith. Tony, just because he happens to believe it, and Tina, because she has a deductively valid argument. Now, suppose both of them, are kind of unsatisfied with their beliefs, and they have a conversion experience. They read the New Testament, then they decide to, join a church and be baptized. At that point, Aquinas would say they have assented to the articles of faith. They believe that Christ died for their sins, that that Jesus is the Son of God, that God is the Trinity, that Jesus rose from the dead, that that he will return to judge the living and the dead, and so forth. Those articles of faith are things that they know through special revelation, and they're moved to assent to them by the grace that God gives them. So Aquinas says in numerous places that a person that assents to the articles of faith doesn't need to have those arguments. Now, of course, they have to, in some sense, kind of have an understanding that there's a God, right? But they don't have to know that as a result of, or believe that as a result of, having a deductively valid argument. And Aquinas says, and the reason is not only the problem of falling into the Pelagian heresy, but the fact is most people don't have the time to study the arguments, and some people just aren't smart enough to figure out the arguments. And we don't want to say that one cannot become a Christian unless they have studied theology and philosophy. That's madness.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Well, one of the more interesting contemporary turns that this book takes is when you bring up the question of monotheism, classical theism, and the question at the heart of the Larisha Hawkins dispute from a few years ago. If you would, give our listeners a short narration of that episode at Wheaton College, and tell us what kinds of questions Thomas teaches us to ask when we consider other monotheistic faith traditions.
Yeah, so Larisha Hawkins was a political science professor at Wheaton College. I don't know her personally, but I got drawn into the debate about her comments on Facebook. She had worn a hijab, which is a headscarf worn by Muslim women, and she wore it in order to show solidarity with her Muslim neighbors. And on Facebook, she says that, and then she says that she cites Pope Francis and says that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. And she said, in fact, I will quote here directly from her Facebook page. She said, "I stand in religious solidarity with Muslims because they, like me, a Christian people, are people of the book. And as Pope Francis stated last week, we worship the same God." So I wound up writing a column on this for an online magazine called The Catholic Thing, and where I defended Professor Hawkins. And I've never had more, I think, negative email from Christians about this. And I was sort of amazed by it, because I just thought it was obvious that Muslims and Christians and Jews worship the same God. And the reason for that, and this is why I bring Aquinas into it, I think that his distinction between the preambles of faith and the articles of faith are very helpful. So if you think about what we can know through our natural reason, according to Aquinas, we can know that God is a creator, that he's created the universe, that he's one, that he's eternal, that he's infinite, omnipotent, omniscient, and so forth. These are all things that we can know when we sort of reflect on the nature of creation. Muslims and Jews believe the same thing about God. They They hold that God is the creator. He's one. He's unique. He is not like anything in the universe. In fact, one of the points I make in the chapter is that God's uniqueness is so great, it's actually a mistake to say that God is one of a kind, because he's not really a kind. He is the being that keeps all kinds and things in existence. He's a sort of above and beyond ordinary existent things, because he doesn't have a beginning or an end. He's eternal. And for, so when I wrote this, when I wrote the original piece, as I said, I got a lot of negative comments, but it caused me to think more deeply about it. And so when I was putting the book together, I thought it would be interesting to sort of write a chapter dealing with this issue and to bring Thomas's insights to it in a more explicit fashion. And so one of the examples that I use in the book or illustrations is I asked the reader to imagine three students who are undergraduates. I think it's at Princeton University that I have them attending. And they're taking a class from an atheist professor, and they conclude that God doesn't exist. They're convinced by the atheist professor, and I give them three sort of explicitly religious or kind of names that are associated with different religious traditions. Their names are Abdullah, Baruch, and Catherine. So Abdullah grew up a Muslim, Baruch grew up Jewish, and Catherine grew up Christian. They go to college, they all became atheists. But then one of their other professors catches wind of this, is bothered by it, thinks that they abandoned their faith too quickly. And so they do a directed study with the professor, and they review the arguments of Avicenna, Aquinas, and Maimonides. And each of them comes to the separate conclusion that God exists. Abdullah is persuaded by, I think I have him persuaded by Aquinas, and Baruch by Maimonides, and Catherine is persuaded by Avicenna, and they all come to the same conclusion that there's a self-existent, eternal God who created the universe.
And by the way, this is already much better than the movie God's Not Dead.
Okay. Oh, thank you. I've not seen that movie, although you're not the first person to bring this up, by the way.
I only watched it because several of my students asked me to watch it so I could give them my take on it, and I did, and it's terrible. But anyway, go ahead.
I don't know how old you are, Nathan, but I'm 59, so I remember back in the 70s the really bad apocalyptic Christian movies. So apparently God's Not Dead is better than that. The movies in which everyone's raptured off the earth and
that's a low bar though.
Yeah. So these three students, they change their mind. They all believe in God. So at this point I say, do they all believe in the same God? Yes, they do. Now, though, let's look more deeply into this. So imagine, though, that they're sort of unsatisfied with this sort of philosophical theism. So they start exploring the traditions from which they came. They read all sorts of literature on Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And it turns out Abdullah becomes, I think, Jewish. Baruch becomes a Christian. And Catherine becomes Muslim. I don't know if I get it exactly right, but in other words, they each of them goes to a different tradition than they had been brought up in. And yet they still believe that God is one, that God is eternal, that he's self-existent, and that he's the creator of the universe. Now, of course, because they align themselves now with different traditions, they believe different things about God. But those different things they believe about God are not the result of anything that they learn through the preambles of faith. It's stuff they learn through what they believe to be special revelation. So the Quran says that God cannot be begat or be begotten. Judaism denies that God is a Trinity and that Christ is the Son of God. So there's all sorts of things that the differing traditions deny. And so in a sense, they still worship the same God, but they just believe different things about that God. Now, a helpful distinction that I think is helpful that I use in the book is the difference between sense and reference. It's a philosophical distinction that philosophers have used for generations. So imagine this. Imagine you've got – this is not an example I use in the book. It's actually an example that I came up with a couple of months ago. So imagine there are twins separated at birth. We'll call them, for convenience sake, Tony and Tina. So Tony is brought up by his by an uncle, and Tina is brought up by an aunt. Tony is told by his uncle what a great person his father was, and Tina is told by his aunt or by her aunt what a terrible father she has, and her biological father. So they both have the same biological father. And yet, each of them holds different beliefs about that father. One of them is told, you know, wonderful things, and the other one is told horrible things. One is told that the father, you know, had to leave them because he's a CIA agent that was asked by his government to help rescue people from oppression, whereas the, you know, Tina is told by her aunt that, no, your father abandoned you to marry a Russian spy, something like that. But they actually have the same reference. That is, they are referring to the same individual, their biological father. The difference is they hold different beliefs, and those different beliefs are the result of people that they trust. And so we know that people can hold different beliefs about the same thing. All I'm doing in this chapter is sort of extending that and using Aquinas's distinction between the preambles of faith and the articles of faith to sort of make that clear.
Very good, very good. We have another chapter on creationism and intelligent design. I made reference to it in the show's opening. And this one also really impressed me. I've been involved in events exploring these movements in the last couple of years on my own campus. Your conversation begins with the concept of intervention and the ways that both creationist and new atheist thought assume intervention as the central model for God's relationship with nature. What's wrong with intervention as a category, philosophically speaking?
Yeah, so one of the things that I discovered when studying intelligent design, and in fact, I'll tell you a little bit about my own history involved with it. I think it'll explain why I have a whole chapter on it. After I did my PhD at Fordham University, about 11 years after that, I went to law school and earned a degree. I didn't earn a kind of usual JD or law degree. I earned a graduate degree in law, and it was called a Master of Juridical Studies. And it was at Washington University in St. Louis. And unlike an ordinary law degree, I had to write a dissertation. And one of the issues that was really in the public square in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I was in law school, was this issue of teaching intelligent design in public schools. And so, given my own interest in political philosophy and some of the debates about liberalism and state neutrality, I thought it would be interesting to explore the question of whether it would be permissible to teach intelligent design in public school, because intelligent design, although it lends itself to a theistic worldview, all the arguments for it tend to be kind of secular, kind of non-theological arguments. And I wound up writing on it and found myself deeply entrenched with this debate in ways that I did not anticipate. In fact, when I was originally hired at Baylor, there was a group of alumni that didn't want me to be hired because of my views. And I actually talk about it a little bit in the book. Well, that kind of got me thinking, though, about intelligent design as a view. Most of my focus in my work had nothing to do with whether ID arguments were good or bad, or even what they said about the role of God and creation. I was sort of just interested in the legal question. Does it violate the Constitution? So I spent a couple of years after I published my initial work on intelligent design and the law kind of reading up on on divine action, that is, how does God act in creation, and questions of science. And one of the things I discovered was how many evangelical colleges have in their statements of faith descriptions of God's creative activity that treats God as a kind of intervener in creation. And so you get things like this. And here's a quote from one college, and I won't mention the name. It says, God created humankind in his image. In the image of God created them, male and female, he created them. And that's a quote from Genesis 1:27. But some of the schools will take that to say something like this, to say that God could use secondary causes takes him out of the equation. So, for example, this is one college says, humans and each kind of organism resulted from God's distinct and supernatural creative intervention and did not result from a natural evolutionary process, nor from an evolutionary process that God secretly directed. In particular, God created man in a distinct and supernatural creative act, forming the specific man, Adam, from non-living material, and the specific woman, Eve, from Adam. And then another evangelical institution, it's actually, there's a distinction made between God creating and evolution or natural forces creating. And so that school says that in order to preserve kind of God's integrity as creator, you can't say that God did not directly intervene to create Adam and Eve, but you could say that God wasn't necessary in those things that could be accounted for by scientific laws. And that kind of really took me for a loop, because I thought to myself, as a Christian and as a classical theist, I believe that not only did God create, Adam and Eve, but he also created the laws. And so to say that somehow God kind of intervenes in his own creation, I think teaches us the wrong lesson, and actually it buys into some of the ways in which people like Richard Dawkins think about God's activity in creation. So let me say a few things about how some intelligent design advocates argue. And I want to, before I do that, I want to say that some of these folks are my friends, and I think that some of them are really smart, and I admire them in many ways, but I think that they're mistaken on this question. And I want to say that because I think sometimes they get treated badly in ways that I think are unfair. So, so having said that, though, I think this is the mistake they make. So Bill Dembski, who's a friend, will say something like this, that in order for us to figure out whether a particular aspect of creation exhibits intelligent design, we have to exclude law, that is scientific laws, and chance. So what's a scientific law? Well, something like gravity, right? Or so when I let go of, let's say I'm holding some Scrabble tiles, I drop them and they fall to the ground. That's a result of scientific law. Well, if I throw them up in the air and they land randomly and they just spell gibberish, that's the result of kind of law plus chance, right? It's just random. But supposing I throw them in the air and they spell something like "Hi, Frank," or "Have a nice day," or "Move to Baltimore," or something like that, you may think, Dembski says, that there could be some intelligent agency behind it, especially if it's a highly complicated phrase. And so he argues that there are certain aspects of the biological world that exhibit that kind of complexity. So therefore, we're justified in saying that God acted in this part of nature. And one of the parts of nature that often gets appealed to is the bacterial flagellum, which is a part of the cell that kind of is like a little – like a motor. So my problem with that view is not that – I mean, for all I know – Dembski's arguments could be great arguments. I don't dispute that. I've read people that have been critical of those arguments, and I've read people that have defended them. And I don't really know where I stand on the quality of the arguments. But I think it teaches the wrong lesson about how God acts. So what it's saying to people like Dawkins is that if you can show that there's a way to account for this highly complex natural phenomenon, therefore we don't believe, then therefore we're not rational in holding that God created that. And I think that's just a mistake, because as Christians, we believe that God not only created the bacterial flagellum and things that show a certain level of complexity and beauty and so forth, we also believe he is the first cause of all those things that don't, upon our immediate awareness, seem to exhibit those high levels of complexity. So I think what it's teaching is something that I don't think as Christians we should accept, that there's a kind of war over particular slivers of nature. And if our arguments are shown to be not plausible, therefore we no longer are rational in holding that God exists. I think that's just a mistake.
Right. I'm reminded of something that my students think I'm a monster when I do this, and they're probably right. But when they tell me that, you know, they had a relative who, you know, went in and, you know, went to their oncologist and they scanned it and the cancer was gone and there was no explanation, so it must be God. My first question is always, well, if they discover what process made that happen, does it mean that God didn't heal your aunt?
Yeah.
And, you know, they think I'm a monster for asking that, but I really do want to know the answer.
Yeah, and I do think, though, it's interesting. That's a really good example. My first work in philosophy actually was on the question of miracles. I did my doctoral dissertation on David Hume's argument against miracles. And one of the issues that I dealt with in the dissertation, which eventually became a book, was what are called coincidence miracles. That is, miracles that, given their timing and high improbability, kind of lend themselves to believing that God was working, but he may have very well used all the laws of nature. So there wasn't any intervention. So the kind of illustration that's used by the first person who kind of used this term, his name was R.F. Holland. He says, imagine a woman sees her child playing on a train tracks about, let's say, a quarter of a mile away, and from her vantage point, she sees the train going around the bend, but she can't scream loud enough for the child to hear her, and she can't get the attention of the engineer on the train, and so she just prays and says, God, help my child. And then at that point, the engineer has a heart attack and collapses on the brake, and the train stops within 2 feet of the child. Everything can be accounted for by natural scientific law. But it seems to me that's not necessarily unreasonable to say that that may have been a miracle. But it's not a miracle in the sense that it's an intervention that violates natural law, but it's a miracle in the sense that all the coincidences themselves kind of speak to something that's deeper. Now, of course, an unbeliever or a skeptic could say, well, I just think it's coincidence. And they certainly are not wrong in maybe thinking that way. But I think it's not unreasonable for people to think that there are ways that God can speak to us through apparently coincidental events. So, I think it's a perfectly legitimate question to raise to your students.
Very good. Very good. One more thing on creation and evolution. I really didn't expect a discussion of Aristotle's four causes in a chapter on evolution and faith, which probably just shows the limits of my imagination. How does a metaphysical expansion beyond the efficient cause help us to think about creation?
Yeah, so one of the objections that is raised against design in nature, and this is one raised by people like Richard Dawkins, is that, well, look, Darwinian evolution can give an account of how we have such highly complex living organisms. So one of the points I make in the book is, okay, let's grant that for the sake of argument, that in fact the complexity of living organisms can be accounted for by natural selection. And I have no doubt that that's probably the case. But there's other types of design or final causality than just a kind of mechanistic view of design. So one of the ways in which Dawkins looks at nature is through the lens of what is called the watchmaker analogy, something that was developed by William Paley. And Paley says, if you're walking across a field and you come across something, a watch, and you don't necessarily know what it is, you assume that it is designed in some way, right? That it has a purpose to it. And he says, look at nature. Nature is far more complex. So I think Dawkins's mistake is he thinks that the design in nature always has to be kind of analogous to artifacts in some way. But that's not the way that, or the only way to think about design. Another way to think about design is something called final causality. That is that things are ordered towards particular ends. So just think about your eyesight. Even if, let's say, your eyesight is the consequence of, or your eyes are consequence of natural selection, it still is the case that your eyes are ordered towards seeing. And we make judgments about whether someone has good or bad sight, right? In fact, I'm wearing glasses right now. I need that because I know that my eyes, their optimal measurement is 20/20. Dawkins himself, I think, falls prey to this. He relies on design himself or final causality when he issues a judgment against a Christian paleontologist who's a young Earth creationist, a gentleman named Kurt Wise, who for years taught at Bryan College in Tennessee. So Kurt grew up in a Christian fundamentalist home, was a young Earth creationist, went off to graduate school, studied paleontology with Stephen Jay Gould, and still came to the conclusion that the Earth is only 10,000 years old, and tells in his own sort of autobiographical account that he says, at this point, I knew that I had to abandon a life as a research scientist at a major university. I had to either accept the Bible or toss it into the flames. And Dawkins says, this is why I hate religion or dislike religion, is because it takes someone as smart as Kurt Wise and throws his career away. And my point is that isn't Dawkins himself acting as by issuing this judgment saying something like this? Kurt Wise is not using his talents appropriately, that he has certain gifts that are ordered towards certain ends, that he has natural intelligence that he's not using in an appropriate way. And that kind of language is final causality language. It's the language of design. But it's not artifactual design. It's a kind of natural design that we presuppose in a variety of judgments. And it's one of the causes that scientists will tell you that they don't use when doing science, but I think that they presuppose it all the time.
Well, it's interesting. When you brought up Dawkins, I thought you were going to point to the selfish gene, whose central thesis is teleological, that genes have a desire that they want to do certain things in the world, and therefore they invent devices to do those things in the world. And this is not my critique. This is David Bentley Hart's, but I mean, that seems to be right at the core of his most, famous early book.
Yeah, so I've always wondered. I mean, I've never, evolution's never been a thing that's bothered me. and maybe it was my upbringing, because I did not grow up in a, that kind of evangelical fundamentalist background. I didn't attend as an undergraduate at any evangelical colleges or universities. So even though, when I was an evangelical and I was, in those circles and speaking at those conferences, I knew many people that were creationists, but I kind of never revealed my views because it just wasn't a big deal to me. And I may have been because, I was sort of aware of these philosophical issues, and I thought that there were a lot of problems with the way in which young Earth creationists interpret Genesis, to give one example, you know, we're told that God walked with Adam in the garden. I mean, we wouldn't say that therefore God had to have legs, right? I mean, there's a lot more going on in this narrative than just kind of literal descriptions. At least
Right, or that when God walked with Adam, God stopped being in one place and became in another place.
That's exactly right. And so yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with this is something actually unique to the American experience. A lot of my friends in the UK and in Eastern and Western Europe who, you know, identify as evangelicals are sort of perplexed by why the issue is such a big deal in the United States. It has a lot to do with the Scopes trial, the history of that, as well as the influence of all people. Seventh-day Adventists were really the first American Christians that really were producing creationist literature. And it wound up influencing sort of the wider, more mainstream evangelical world. But even if you go back to the series of books called The Fundamentals, which is where we get the term fundamentalist, it's based on a series of articles published in response to modernism in American Protestantism. There's an article in one of those books by James Orr, the great Scottish theologian, defending theistic evolution. And I tell this to people that, you know, the early fundamentalists really didn't get connected to creationism until the Scopes trial. That was a sort of interesting historical moment.
Very good. Well, I want to turn in these last few minutes to questions of Protestants and Catholics. When I turned to your chapter on grace and works, I remembered that over the years, Stanley Hauerwas has taught me to think about grace in phenomenological terms before I get cosmic. So concretely speaking, God sent human beings into my life, people I neither invented nor compelled to teach me, so that I could learn from them the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I think I saw some of that in your discussion of grace and works. What does it mean for God to be operative and cooperative in the habits of grace?
Yeah. So one of the things that perplexed me when I was a younger evangelical were the number of evangelical Thomists who read back into who read Aquinas as a kind of paleo Lutheran. and so when I began reading Aquinas on grace, the thing that I found just kind of liberating was that the way in which the sort of popular way in which the debate between Protestant and Catholic understandings of grace and works is that it's either one or the other, right? Or it's either faith or works.
Well, maybe, Luther says that pretty explicitly on the bondage of the will. If even the smallest bit is works, then God's grace means nothing.
And so the thing though for Aquinas though, that he says that when God gives us the grace so that we can move our will to assent to him. But that grace is what, and this is a kind of technical theological term, is a divine quality. It's like real stuff that changes us. And so the point of it is that's called sanctifying grace. And that sanctifying grace has an operative aspect to it in the sense that it actually sort of changes us, but also has a cooperative aspect to it in the sense that it allows us to welcome God and other Christians to work with us so that we can be transformed from the inside out. So in a way, we are exercising our will, but not in a way competitive with God, but aligned with him. So an illustration that I use in another work, and I don't use it in this, or I may use it in this. I've written so much on this, I forget where I wrote certain things. So think about the way in which we think about something called inscripturation. That is, why is it we believe that the Bible is inspired word of God? So oftentimes Christians will say that the Bible is God's word, and yet Paul wrote Romans. We don't say that Paul and God are co-authors. We say that it is wholly Paul's work, but also wholly God's work. If you can understand that, you can understand what Aquinas means by the role of grace in the development of the believer's virtue. That is, God made us a particular sort of creature, a creature with free will, a creature with an intellect and a will. But that intellect and that will has been corrupted by original sin. The role of grace is to heal that so that we can cooperate for our own transformation. And it's a mystery. And I think in a way, in a weird way, it's similar to the problem with intelligent design. That is, it's almost as if we need to, if it's either our will or it's either our faith or our act or God's grace. It can't be both. It's either, so to go back to intelligent design, it's either natural or scientific law, or it's God's intervention. And I think they both make the same mistake. And I think they make this mistake because they think of God's divine action as needing room. And I think my own view is that actually lowers or limits God and is kind of doesn't really think of God in the full omnipotent sense that, let's say, classical theists like Aquinas have thought of God.
Very good. Well, Frank, I want to pose a question that emerges from the beginning of the book here at the end. You and I are both professors who teach philosophical and theological texts. Our listeners are literate people. They love books. So the people in this room, so to speak, don't need explanations for the ways in which study adds complexity and richness to the life of faith. But folks who are more suspicious of such study often know one episode from the life of Thomas, and that's his late life utterance that, quote, "all I have written seems to me as straw," end quote. For our listeners who know such people, how does a scholar of the work of Thomas Aquinas do with that word as you continue to study and teach philosophy?
Well, the one thing that Aquinas says in his Summa Theologica and Summa Contra Gentiles is that once we encounter God in the afterlife, in the beatific vision, once we see God as he truly is, everything will appear to us as straw because we will be fully one with him. And I think what we get at the end of Aquinas' life is he was given a special grace. He was one of the few people, I believe, that was actually got to see the beatific vision for a small moment. And I think that's why he said what he said. So I think unless you are fortunate and blessed enough to encounter the beatific vision, you should, like the rest of us mere mortals, study people like Aquinas and others. And maybe as a result of that, you will actually have that encounter at some point in your life.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Frank, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I want you to have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about Thomas Aquinas, Christian thought, or whatever else as we head for the door?
I think, you know, the thing about Aquinas, and I would include Aquinas with the whole plethora of Christian thinkers that I think we ignore at our own peril. There's so many issues that we are talking about and thinking about today theologically, philosophically, that have been discussed and I think answered by these thinkers. And I think we shouldn't have to reinvent the wheel every generation. That's not to say we shouldn't think about different ways to apply these great thinkers, but I think we should, go to them for advice and counsel. And I think Aquinas is one of them. And what I tried to do in the book was to try to do a little bit of that, to sort of bring Aquinas as a kind of consultant to issues that I think are interesting across the Christian spectrum.
Frank Beckwith, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a delight.
Listeners, thank you for downloading. Thank you for listening in. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. The book you've heard us talking about is Never Doubt Thomas from Baylor University Press. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.